This last he said as if repeating an adage known the world over. "Until you took me, I knew nothing of the servants or Clara's." It was not quite a lie. I had read a tiny bit about them in my father's papers, but not enough to prepare me for what I now endured.
"Perhaps it is because you are so young,"
Vindelire replied thoughtfully. He gave me a pitying look. I shook my head. My hair was now long enough to turn to curls in the rain, and droplets flew from it. "I don't think they are as famed as you believe them to be. Curf, had you heard of Clara's before the servants hired you?" He turned slowly toward me, blue eyes widening in slow consternation, like a puzzled cow.
"Hush," Vindelire warned me. "Don't ask him questions."
Vindelire furrowed his brow, and as he did, Curf's face settled into his habitual scowl. Alertness faded from his eyes. I stood up suddenly and stretched, choosing to do so just as two young deckhands dashed by. Both avoided me, but one turned to look back at me in surprise. I looked directly at him, smiling. He stumbled, caught himself, turned back, and I think he would have spoken to me if someone hadn't roared a rebuke at him. The command was accompanied by the sound of a rope length snapping against the ship's railing. Both boys fled to their work. I sat down slowly. Vindelire was breathing through his nose as harshly as if he had just run a race. The world settled around me as if I had been paddling on the surface of a sea and now sank in stillness below the waves. I avoided his gaze as I tried to quote what he had said. "Clara's is the heart of the world, and the heartbeat of the world must always be steady." I peered at him through a sudden blast of rain. I could not tell if the water running down his face was rain or tears. His chin quivered briefly.
"We who serve the servants aid them to keep that heart beating steadily. If we obey, if we keep to the path."
"But what about you?" I asked him. "What harm if you went to a festival and ate roasted nuts and drank spiced cider? There's no evil in that." His little round eyes were full of misery.
"But no good either. I must do only what keeps the world to the path. Harm can come of simple things. The cake I eat, another person lacks. Like tiny pebbles that shift till the hillside gives way, carrying a road into oblivion."
Had I heard such a thing a long time ago? His words rang strangely, even as I hated the sense of them. If he believed that Dwalia knew his destiny and he followed her direction, I had no hope of enlisting his help to escape. As if he heard my thought, he said,
"That is why I cannot help you defy her. If you try to escape, I must stop you and bring you back."
He shook his head.
"She was very angry when you ran away in the city. I said I could not make you be obedient. I did it once, that first time. The power was fresh and strong on me that day. She had readied me for the hard work I did. But since then, I cannot make you obey me. She said I was lying. She slapped me many times."
His tongue moved inside his cheek as if finding sore places. I felt a rush of guilty sympathy for him. "Oh, brother," I said, and took his hand. It was like thrusting my hand into a cold rush of water. I felt the current that strongly, like touching my father when his thoughts were unguarded, before I had learned how to protect myself. I felt that his current snatched the thoughts from my mind. I sensed his hold on Curf like a strangling rope around his mind. Curf was no weakling. It was taut with tension, a leash on a lunging dog. I snatched my hand back and tried to disguise what I'd felt by patting his sleeved arm sympathetically. "I am sorry she punished you for that." He stared at me.
"You thought of your father?"
My heart was beating very fast. "Walls, walls, walls!" "I miss my father constantly," I said. He reached for me and I stood up. "I'm so cold. I'm going inside. Curf, are you not cold?" Curf's eyes flickered, and Vindelire was distracted as he brought his lunging dog to heel again. By the time he had mastered Kerf and had him standing to follow me, I was out of his reach, on my way back to the cabin. A deckhand, coiling a rope, paused in his activity and stared at me. So Vindalaya had been concealing me and controlling Kerf, but doing both at the same time strained his abilities. A useful bit of information. However, I had handed him a weapon I wished he did not have. Did he guess that if he touched me, skin to skin, he might be able to push inside my mind? I did not look back at him or let my thoughts dwell on that. I must do better at guarding my thoughts. I now doubted that I'd be able to lure either Vindalaya or Kerf into helping me. An old sailor strode past me, wet shirt plastered to his back, bare feet slapping the deck. He did not even glance at me. I reached the hatch and climbed down the ladder that led into the bowels of the ship, where our miserable compartment awaited me. I threaded my way past dangling hammocks and sea chests. As I went, I studied those I passed. A few Chalcedian merchants had clustered to mutter about weather and pirates. I paused near them. None looked at me, but from their talk I learned that our ship was bragged to be the swiftest out of Chalced. She had never been boarded by pirates, though she had been pursued by them more than once. She had also avoided encounters with the so-called Tariff Fleet and slipped unnoticed past the pirate isles without paying toll to Queen Etta and her cutthroats. "Are the pirate ships that might chase this ship part of the Tariff Fleet?" I asked aloud, but no one turned toward me. Yet a moment later, a younger fellow at the edge of the huddle said, "It seems ironic to me that a queen who rules a domain called the Pirate Isles is now troubled herself by pirates." A grey-moustached merchant laughed aloud.
"Ironic and very satisfying to those of us who once had to run the Pirate Isles corridor, hoping to escape the attention of King Kennet. He'd take ship, crew, and cargo and turn it all to his own purposes. Anyone who could not bring a ransom ended up a resident of the Pirate Isles."
"Kennet or Ygritte?" asked the youngster.
"Kennet,"
the older man affirmed.
"Ygritte was before my time, and a much more brutal beast. He'd take the cargo, slaughter and rape the crew, and then scuttle the vessel. He had a live ship and nothing outruns one of those. He choked trade for years. Then one day, he simply vanished."
He widened his eyes at the younger man and mockingly asserted,
"Some say that on a stormy night, you can glimpse his ghost ship in the distance with her sails blazing and the figurehead shrieking in agony."
There was a moment of silence as the young man stared at him, and then all burst into laughter.
"Do you think we'll elude Queen Etta's Tariff Fleet?"
the younger man asked, trying to regain a bit of dignity. The older merchant tucked his hands into his ornate sash. He pursed his lips and waxed philosophical.
"We will, or we won't. The deal I struck was that if the ship can get us past the Tariff Fleet, I'll pay the captain half what I would have paid them. It's a good bargain, and it's one I've made with him before. On 3 voyages out of 5, we slipped past them. Good odds, I think. That little offer of mine makes him willing to crack on a bit more sail, I do believe."
"Good odds indeed,"
the young man replied. I heard awkward steps coming down the ladder and looked up to see Kerf descending with Vindalaya following him.
"There you are," I said brightly. "I hurried ahead to be out of the rain."
Kerf said nothing, but Vindalaya regarded me with a scowl.
"We'd best return to our cabin,"
he said stiffly. He walked Kerf past me. I stood where I was.
"What will become of me?" I demanded aloud. "What does Dwalia intend for me? Why did she come so far, destroy so much, and shed so much blood? She sold Elaria into slavery to get us away from Chalced, without a thought for one who had travelled so far with her. Why didn't she sell me, or you?"
"Hush!"
Vindalaya spoke in a soft whisper.
"I cannot speak to you here."
"Is that because they cannot hear me, or see me, and they will think you a madman, talking to yourself?"
I lifted my voice and spoke each word clearly. I saw his control of Kerf slipping as one of the men turned his head, scowling, wondering if he'd heard something. An instant later, Vindalaya had Kerf blank-eyed again. He looked at me, trembling from the effort. There was a tremor in his voice as he said,
"Brother, please."
I should have felt only hatred for him. He had facilitated my capture and kept me subdued as they whisked me away.
He had hidden Shan and me from any who might have helped us, and still he made me invisible. I was Dwelia's prisoner, but he was my jailer. It was irrational for me to feel pity for him, yet I did. I tried to keep my stare icy as tears welled in his pale eyes.
"Please,"
he breathed again, and I broke. "In the cabin, then," I said in a lower, more rational voice. His voice was squeezed so tight with fear that it squeaked.
"She will hear us. No."
One of the merchants turned away from his fellows and stared at Vindelire accusingly.
"Sir, do you listen in on our private conversation?"
"No, no. We came in from the rain to be dry for a bit, that's all."
"And you have nowhere to stand but here beside us?"
We are leaving. Now."
Vindelire gave me a desperate glance, then prodded Kerf. It must have seemed strange to the merchant that they went right back up the ladder and out onto the stormy deck. I followed more slowly. Vindelire was shivering as he led us back to the deckhouse, but one of the ship's boys had claimed our spot and was enjoying a pipe there. He glanced at Vindelire and then looked away. I cleared my throat loudly. The boy did not so much as startle.
"Brother!"
Vindelire rebuked me and trudged down the deck, Kerf following listlessly. The rain had increased, driven by a rising wind. There was no sheltered place. He stopped and leaned miserably on the railing.
"She will kill me if she finds I've answered your questions."
He gave me a sideways glance.
"If I don't answer, you will push me past what I can do. It is harder and harder to hide you. I hear a troop of men from an entire town. Why are you so hard to hide?"
I didn't know and didn't care.
"Why me?" I demanded of him. "Why did you destroy my home and ruin my life?"
He shook his head slowly, deeply hurt at my failure to understand.
"Not to ruin your life," he objected. "To set you on the true path, to control you, lest you create a false way and carry us all to a terrible future."
I stared at him. He sighed.
"P, this makes you important. You are part of the true path. For so long, there were dreams of the unexpected son. Hundreds of dream scrolls mention him, and some are very old. He is full of crossroads. His existence is a junction, a nexus, Symph says. You create more and more junctions. You are dangerous."
He hunched down to look into my rain-spattered face.
"Do you understand?"
"No." He put his hands to both sides of his head and squeezed as if to stifle a pain. Water slid down his face, tears or raindrops or sweat. Kerf stared out over the sea in bovine passivity, not sheltering his face from the driving rain. The storm was rising. The sails were making a slapping sound. The ship rose and then fell, making my stomach lurch.
"More dreams mean something is more likely,"
Vindelire went on.
"The unexpected sun brings change to the world. If you are not controlled, you will set the world on an inappropriate course. You are a danger to the servants, to Clarys. In all the dreams, he changes things so much that no one can predict the future. You have to be stopped."
He clamped his mouth shut on his words.
"And you think I am him?"
I asked incredulously. I lifted my arms wide to show how small I was.
"If you don't stop me, I will ruin the world. Me?"
A gust of wind slapped me.
"How do you stop me? Kill me?"
I snatched at the railing as the ship jolted. The wind roared and the rain pelted us harder.
"You must be him."
His words were a distressed plea. I thought he would crumple into tears.
"Dwelia said if I found the wrong one, she would kill me. She was so angry when she found out you were a girl. That was when she started to doubt me. And you. But it is simple to me. If you are not him, who can you be? I dreamed finding you in my only true dream. You are him, and unless we take you to Clara's, you will change the world's path.
He suddenly spoke sternly.
When we come to Clara's, we must make everyone believe that you are the unexpected son and we did a good thing. You must make them believe you are him. If we don't...
Then he clapped his mouth shut so suddenly and firmly that it made a popping sound. His eyes grew wide as he stared over my head at nothing. When he shifted his gaze back to me, I saw anger and betrayal in his glare.
You are doing it, aren't you? Right now, you are making me tell you things, and then you will know and you will change things. Because you are him, you fight me when I tried to hide you. You make Dwalia angry with me. You ran away, and so many died, and we caught you again, but Repin died, and Alaria was sold. Now there's just Dwalia and me and this kerf. All those others. You changed all their lives into deaths. That is what the unexpected son would do.
He looked furious. Fear gripped me. He had come so close to being my ally. I choked on disappointment.
Brother, I said, and my voice wavered. Those things only happened because you stole me.
I didn't want to cry, but the sobs ripped from my chest. I shouted my words past my tight throat.
It wasn't me, it was Dwalia. She came and she killed people. She brought all those Lurics there to die, not me, not me.
I sank to my knees. He couldn't be right. All that death couldn't be my fault.
Fitzvigilant. Per's father. Revel. I couldn't be the reason for that.
The storm rose with my fear. It felt as if it were coming out of my chest and blowing all around us. A wave leapt over the railing. It splashed over me, and reflexively I grabbed Kerf's leg. I heard someone shout a command, and three men went racing past us. The nose of the ship began to tip up, as if we were going up a steep hill. One of the men shouted at Vindelire,
"Get below, you idiot!"
as he ran past. I stood up, bracing myself against the deck. The wind blew all around us. We hovered. Then the ship tipped again, and we were sliding downhill on the wet deck. I skidded past Vindelire, shrieking,
"Grab her!"
Vindelire ordered Kerf.
"Get her back to the cabin!"
Kerf stooped and seized a handful of the back of my shirt. He dragged me like a sack as he staggered aft toward the hatch, with Vindelire holding on to him. Men cursed as they avoided us. They moved purposefully, but I could make no sense of the shouted commands. Sailors climbed masts and into rigging, while storm winds slashed at them and the canvas cracked at each gust. The deck tipped again. We reached the hatch cover, but it was closed. Vindelire crouched and pounded on it, shrieking to be let in. Kerf dropped me and went to one knee. He groaned as he lifted the hatch cover and slid it aside. We more tumbled than climbed down the ladder. Above us, someone slammed the cover shut. We were plunged into dimness. For a moment, it felt safe. Then the rough plank floor tipped. In the darkness, I heard a cry of dismay, but someone laughed and mocked.
"You'll never be a merchant boy if a bit of rough water makes you yell." "Put out that lantern!"
someone shouted. In an instant, the blackness became absolute and the world seesawed around me. I could not tell in which direction our miserable cabin lay, but Kerf knew. Vindelire said by my ear,
"Follow us."
And I did. I clutched at Vindelire's shirt and walked in short steps, bumping into beams, a hammock, a sea chest, and finally stumbling through an opening that proved to be our cabin door. The floor tilted. I crouched and then sat flat, pushing my palms against the deck to try to stay in one place. When Kerf tried to shut the door, I discovered that I was sitting in the way. I scooted into the room on my rump, fearing to stand. I groped and slid until I found a corner and bracketed myself in it. There I sat in the dark, cradling my bruised hand in my lap. I was wet through, my hair dripping on my neck. Despite the closeness of the cabin, I felt chilled and hopeless. Let Dwalia be as angry as she pleased. I needed a real answer. "Why did you steal me? What are you going to do with me?" I spoke the words loud and clear into the dark. I heard Dwalia shift in the bunk as the ship lurched in another direction.
"Make her be quiet,"
she ordered Vindelire.
"Make her fall asleep."
He can't. I can block him out of my mind. He can't control me.
Well, I can. I can control you with a stick, so you'd best be quiet.
It was a threat, but her voice was misery, laced with anger, and a trace of fear. The motion of the ship suddenly pressed me back into my corner. I felt like a kitten in a crate that someone was shaking. I didn't like it at all, but I reminded myself that the sailors on deck had looked busy and challenged, but not terrified. I refused to be afraid. You don't have a stick, and you couldn't see me to hit me if you did. Are you afraid to answer me? Why did you steal me? What are you going to do with me? She sat up suddenly in the bed. I knew because I heard the rustle of the blanket and the solid thud as her head hit the upper bunk. I smothered my laugh and then let it burst out of me. In the dark and the tossing storm, defying her, I suddenly felt strangely powerful. I threw words at her. I wonder if the ship will sink. Then all your plans would be for nothing. Imagine if it sank with us stuck in here. Even if we got out of the cabin, we'd never find the ladder and the hatch in the dark. We'd all die here when the cold water came rushing in to find us. I wonder if it would flip upside down first. I heard Vindelai take in a ragged breath. Pity for him warred with satisfaction. Could I make them feel how scared and sick I had been when they stole me? The ship tilted again. Then it felt as if we hit something, then passed through it. A moment later, I heard Dwalia vomit. There had been a bucket by her bunk, but I heard the thin trickle of bile spatter on the deck as she strained and gagged. The smell grew stronger. You thought I was the unexpected son. Then you thought I wasn't. Well, I think I am, and I am changing the world right now. You will never know how I change it, for I think you will die before we reach port. You have certainly lost flesh and strength, and if you die and Vindelire is left alone with us, well, I doubt I shall go to Clary's. I laughed again. There was an instant of absolute silence, as if both storm and ship paused. She spoke into it.
What will I do with you? I will do to you what I did to your father. I will tear you into pieces. I will have every secret out of you if I must take every inch of your skin off your meat to do it. And when I am done with you, I will give you to the breeders. They have wanted one of your lineage for a long time. No matter how I disfigure you, I imagine they will find someone willing to rape you until you conceive. You are young. I imagine they can get a score of babies out of your belly before your body gives out.
She made a cawing sound. I'd never heard Dwalia laugh, but I knew it for what it was. Cold fear, colder than the wild seawater outside the wall of our cabin, rose in me. Confusion ruled me. What was she telling me? I tried to find that confidence again.
You did nothing to my father. You never even saw my father.
A pause as the floor shifted in a new direction. In that silence, I heard the timbers of the ship mutter to one another. Then she spoke, and she was the darkness itself.
So you do not even know who your father was.
I know my father.
Do you? Do you know his pale hair and eyes? Do you know his mocking smile and long-fingered hands? I think not. But I do. I blinded those eyes. I put the mockery out of them forever. And I flayed the tips from your father's long fingers. That was after I'd tugged out his nails, a thin slice at a time. He'll never juggle again, nor make an apple appear from thin air. I ended his dancing and tumbling, too. I peeled the skin from his feet, oh so slowly, and I put his left foot between two blocks of a vice, one on each side, and slowly, slowly I tightened it, less than a quarter turn for each question. It did not matter if he answered me or not. I asked, and he shrieked or cried out words. And then I tightened the screw, tighter and tighter, with the top of his foot bulging up until crunch.
She cawed again.
I could hear Vindelire panting in the darkness. Did he try not to laugh? Was he on the edge of weeping?
The bones gave way. One stuck up like a little ivory tower from the top of his foot. Oh, how he screamed. I stood beside him, and I looked up at my witnesses, and waited until he could scream no more. And then I tightened the screw another quarter turn.
For a long moment, the world paused around me. Even the ship seemed to hover, motionless and nearly level. A father I did not know? A father she had tortured? She had tortured someone. Of that I was certain. She spoke of it as if it were the most delicious meal she had ever eaten, or the loveliest song ever heard. But my father? I knew my father. He was Nettle's father, too, and he was my mother's husband all those years. Of course he was my father. But as if my world teetered while the ship did, the question had to rise. What if he was not my father? What if he never had been? Barrick hadn't been Nettle's father. I would not have been the first child handed off to foster parents. But Molly was my mother. Of that, I was certain. Unless... I wondered an unthinkable thing about my mother. Would not that explain why I looked nothing like him? Wouldn't it explain why he had left me so easily that day? He'd said he had to go, that he had to save the battered old beggar man. The blind beggar man, with the broken hand and the lumpy foot. And then the ship made a slow, sickening tip. I felt the ship must stand on its nose. Did we move? I could not tell until the sickening impact, both hard and soft. Something thudded into the wall beside me and then fell to the deck as the ship tried to right herself. I felt we sank and then bobbed up like a cork. Even below the deck I heard a crash and men shouting. I wondered what had happened.
Sounds like we lost some rigging, maybe even a mast.
Kerf's voice came deep and slow in the darkness. Then with rising urgency he asked,
Where are we going? When did we board a ship? I was taking my prize, my one woman, home to my mother. Where is she? How did we get here?
Control him!
Twalia warned Vindelire savagely, but he made no response. I slid my foot across the floor, and in the dark, I found a yielding lump. I think Vindelire hit his head, I said, then cursed myself for a fool. He was unconscious and could not stop me. I did not think Kerf would care. This was my best chance to kill her and free all of us. The ship was shuddering around us. Without warning, it began to climb again. I heard Vindelire's body slide across the floor. Weapon. I needed a weapon. There was nothing in the room that would serve me as a weapon. I had nothing I could use to kill her. Except Kerf.
You are a prisoner, as am I.
I tried to deepen and smooth my voice. I needed to sound rational and older, not like a terrified child. They took Alaria from you and sold her as a slave. Before that, they lost Lady Shun for you forever by tricking you into bringing her back to her captors instead of taking her home to safety. Remember, Kerf? Remember how they dragged you through a magic stone and almost made you lose your mind? They did it again, and now they have tricked you into leaving Chaelsed and your home behind. Despite my efforts, my voice had gone higher and childish as I tried to sting him with the wrongs done to him. He made no response to my words. I risked it all.
We have to kill her. We must kill Dwalia. It's the only way we can stop her.
You evil little bitch!
Dwalia shrieked at me. I heard her scrabbling, trying to get out of her bunk, but the tilt of the ship was on my side. She was downhill from me. I could not wait for Kerf. He was too addled still. I tried to move quietly in the dark as I half-crawled and half-slid toward her. I had only moments to reach her before the ship would level itself on a wave's crest. I slid into the edge of the bunk, fought to stand, and felt for her. She was struggling to rise. I tried not to touch her, to give her no warning of where I was or what I intended. I had to guess where her neck was as I darted my hands toward her head. I touched her nose and chin with one hand, shifted down and seized her throat in both hands. I gripped and squeezed. She slapped me, hard on the side of my head. My ear rang. I held tight, but my hands were too small. At best, I was pinching the sides of her neck, not throttling her of air as I'd hoped to do. She screamed words at me that I did not understand, but I could hear the hatred in them. I snaked my head in to try to bite her throat and found her cheek instead. That would not kill her, but I bit her anyway, clenching my teeth tight in her meaty face and trying to grind my teeth together. She screamed and battered at me with her fists, and I suddenly knew she was hitting me, hoping that I'd let go, because she feared to tear me away from her face, knowing that I'd take a bite of it with me. Living meat is much tougher than cooked. I worked my teeth back and forth, grinding through her flesh, feeling savage and triumphant in equal measure. She was hurting me, but it would cost her. I'd see to that. I closed my jaws and worried her flesh as if I were a wolf shaking a rabbit. Then Kerf blundered into us. I knew a surge of hope. With him helping me, we could kill her. The ship was upright. He could draw his sword and stab it right into her. I wanted to shout this to him, but I would not let go my bite. Then, to my horror, he seized me.
"Let go,"
he said in the dull voice of a sleepwalker.
"Pull her off,"
Vindalaya ordered him. He'd only been temporarily stunned.
"No! No, no, no!"
Dwalia was shrieking. She seized hold of my head and held it close to her face. But Kerf was stronger. I felt my teeth meet, and then as he jerked me away, the meat of her face tore and came with me. As if I were a shovelful of dirt, Kerf tossed me aside. I hit the floor, spat Dwalia's cheek out, and then slid as the ship began to tilt again. I wound up in a corner and braced myself there. Dwalia was screaming hysterically as Vindalaya nattered at her, demanding was she hurt, what was wrong, what should he do now? I gagged at what I had done. Her blood slimed my chin. I scraped my teeth over my tongue and spat Dwalia out on the floor. Vindalaya was busy with Dwalia. I had no idea where Kerf was or what he was doing.
Get out!
As soon as she could, she would beat me. I knew now how much she would enjoy hurting me. Nothing would stop her from killing me now. In the darkness of the tossing ship, I'd lost my bearings. When the ship pressed me to one wall, I spidered along it, but encountered no doorframe. The ship hit the wall of water and wrenched sideways. Yells of dismay came from the sailors working the deck. So now it was time to fear something bigger than Dwalia. I decided I would be frightened of the ship sinking after I got out of the cabin and away from her. The next time the ship tilted, I went with it to the opposite wall. I was halted briefly by someone's boot, probably Kerf's. I struck the wall, felt the doorframe, pulled myself up, opened the door, and climbed around it until I fell out of it. I heard it fall back into place behind me. Dwalia was still screaming curses at me. I wondered how long I had before they realized I was not in the cabin. I crawled off into the darkness of the tilting deck beneath the swinging hammocks. I heard curses and prayers and grown men weeping. I blundered into an upright post and clung there for a moment. I made myself be still, forced myself to recall what I had seen of the between decks area. Then, as the ship crested another wave, I made my way to the next post. I clung, waited, and then moved again, blundering past a man. On and away. If I drowned when the ship sank, I would not drown next to Dwalia.
Chapter 14. Paragon's Bargain. In the matter of the wild-born wight, known as Beloved, we have been unable to confirm the village of his birth. All records of his coming to Clarys either have been incorrectly stored or have been destroyed. In my opinion, Beloved has found a way to infiltrate our record chambers, has located the records that pertain to him and his family, and has hidden or destroyed them. Tractable when we first received him, he has become unmanageable, inquisitive, deceptive, and suspicious. He remains convinced that he is the true white prophet, and will not regard our teachings that out of several candidates, the servants choose who is best suited for this task. neither kindness nor harsh discipline has shaken this belief in him. Although he would be a valuable addition to the white lineages when he comes of age to breed, his temperament and outspoken ways mean that it would be a dangerous distraction to the others to allow him to continue to have unfettered access to them. I present to my three peers my opinion. It was an error for the boy to be coddled and spoiled. The plan to lull him into security and harvest his dreams has only encouraged him to be rebellious and secretive, to continue to allow him to range freely, to visit the village, and to mingle with our other charges is to invite disaster. My suggestions are these. As our white prophet has suggested, mark him clearly with tattoos. Confine him. Continue to spice his meals with the dream drugs, and see that he is well supplied with brush, ink, and scrolls. Contain him for 20 years. Stroke his vanity. Tell him we hold him in isolation so that his dreams cannot be tainted by the talk of others. Tell him that while he is not the true white prophet, he serves the world and the path by continuing to dream. Allow him pastimes, but do not let him mingle with other whites. If by the end of that time he has not become manageable, poison him. These are my suggestions. Ignore them, and I will take none of the blame for what he does.
Simph. Give a man a dreaded task, then put him in a situation where he must wait to attempt that task. Make it a difficult task as well. Confine him where there is little for him to do and rare opportunity to be alone. Time will stand still for that man. I know this to be true. I tried to fill my days aboard Paragon with useful pursuits. Amber and I would isolate ourselves in her cabin for a session of reading and discussing Bee's dream writings. Those sessions were painful to me, made only more chafing by the fool's avaricious consumption of her journal.
"Read that again,"
he would command me, or worse.
"Does not that dream tie in with the one you read me 4 days ago? Or was it 5? Go back in the book, Fitz, please. I must hear the two read together."
He savored the dreams that he claimed were proof Bee was his child, but I was tormented by unremembered moments of my little girl. She had written those carefully penned words alone, and illustrated them with inks and brushes pilfered from my desk. She had labored on all these pages, each illustration so exact, each letter so precisely inked, and I had known nothing of her obsession. Had she done this work late at night, while I slept? Or perhaps while I ignored her and Molly to morosely pen my own thoughts in my private study? I didn't know, and would never know. Every recounted dream, every peculiar little poem or detailed illustration was a rebuke to the father I had been. I could avenge her death. I could kill as my memorial to her, and perhaps die in the effort and end my shame. But I could not undo how I had neglected the child. Every time the fool exclaimed over how cleverly she had worded a rhyme, it was like a tiny burning coal of shame deposited on my heart. The weather held fine for us. The ship operated smoothly. When I walked on the deck, I felt as if the crew moved around me while they trod the intricate steps of a dance to a music only they could hear. The river current swept us along for the first part of our journey with little need for canvas. The dense green walls of the sky-tall forest towered higher than any mast. Sometimes the river raced deep and swift, and the trees were so close that we smelled the flowers and heard the raucous cries of the birds and nimble creatures that inhabited every level. One morning, I woke late to find that the river had been joined by a tributary and now spread wide and flat round us. On the left side of the ship, the forest had retreated to a green haze on the horizon. "What's over there?" I asked Clef when he paused near me in his duties. He squinted. "Don't know. Water's too shallow for Paragon or any large ship. There's just this one channel down the middle, and we're damn lucky the Paragon knows it as well as he does. On that far side, the river gets shallower and then gives on to stinking grey mudflats that would suck a man down to his hips, and they stretch at least a day's walk, maybe two, before trees start again.
He shook his head and mused. So much of the Rain Wilds isn't for humans. We're better off remembering that not all the world is made for us. Hey, hey, you don't coil a line like that. He was off down the deck and I was left staring across the water. The river bore us ever closer to the coast, and I became aware by my wit and skill both that the ship was not a passive component of our journey. By day, I sensed his awareness. Does he steer himself? I asked Amber at one point.
To some degree, every part of him that touches water is made of wizard wood, or more accurately, dragon cocoon. The Rain Wilders built the ships that way because the water of this river eats anything else away quickly, or so it was at one time. I understand that the Jomalians have come up with a way of treating wood that lets an ordinary ship ply this river without being eaten. Impervious ships, they call them, or so I'm told. A live ship would have some control over its rudder, but only some. Paragon can also control every plank of his hull. He can tighten or loosen. He can warn his crew if he's leaking. Wizardwood seems able to heal after a fashion, if a live ship scrapes bottom or collides with another vessel.
I shook my head in wonder. A marvelous creation indeed. The slight smile Amber had been wearing faded.
Not created by men or even by shipbuilders. Every live ship was meant to be a dragon. Some remember that more clearly than others. Each ship is truly alive, Fitz. Puzzled in some cases, angry or confused in others, but alive.
As if that had given her some new thought, she turned away from me, set her hands on the railing, and stared out across the grey water. Our shipboard days quickly fell into a pattern. We breakfasted with Brashen or Althea, but seldom both. One or the other of them always seemed to be on deck, prowling about with a keen eye. Spark and Perseverance kept themselves busy. The rigging seemed to both fascinate and daunt them, and they challenged each other daily. It was a task for Lant to corner them and settle them to letters and learning. Spark could already write and read, but had a limited understanding of Six Duchies' geography or history. It was fortunate that she seemed to enjoy the hours Lant spent instructing her, for Per could not have endured being kept at pen and paper while Spark roved the ship. Often enough, the lessons were held on the deck, while Amber and I quietly plotted imaginary murders. The noon meal was less formal, and often I had little appetite for it, having spent my morning in idleness. It troubled me that the skills I had fought to regain at Buckkeep were now becoming rusty again, but I saw no way to drill with an axe or a sword that would not have invited questions or created alarm. In the afternoon, Amber and I were often closeted with Bee's books. We took our evening meal with Brashen and Althea. The ship was usually anchored by then, or tied off to trees, depending on the river's condition. After the evening meal, I was often left to my own devices, for Amber spent almost every evening with Paragon. She would don a shawl and make her way to the foredeck, where she would settle herself cross-legged on the peak of the bow and talk with him. Sometimes, to my discomfort, Paragon would hold her in his hands. She would sit on his palms, his thumbs under her hands so she could face him, and they would converse far into the dark. At his request, she borrowed a small set of pipes from Clef and played for him, low, breathy music that seemed to be about loneliness and loss. Once or twice, I wandered forward to see if I might join them, for I confess the curiosity seethed in me as to what they might be talking about for so many nights. But without insult, it was made plain to me that I was not to be included in their discussions. The galley and the area below decks were the province of the crew. On Paragon, I was not only a stranger, a foreigner, and a prince, but also the idiot who had upset the figurehead and let him publicly threaten me. The rattling games of chance played below decks and the crew's rough humor was not to be shared with the likes of me. So as often as not, I spent the evening alone in the cramped cabin Spark shared with the fool. I kept my mind busy as best I could, usually with leafing through Bee's books. Sometimes I was invited to Althea and Brashen's stateroom for wine and casual talk, but I was keenly aware that my companions and I were their cargo rather than their guests. So when I politely declined an invitation one evening, my dismay rose when Brashen said bluntly,
"No, we need to talk. It's important."
A little silence held as I followed him back to their stateroom. Althea was already there, with a dusty bottle of wine on the table and three glasses. For a brief time, all three of us pretended that this was no more than a chance to share a fine vintage and unwind at the end of the day. The anchored ship rocked gently in the river's current. The windows were open overlooking the river, and the night sounds of the nearby forest canopy reached us.
"We'll leave the river tomorrow afternoon and head toward Bingtown,"
Brashen announced suddenly. "We've made good time, I think," I said agreeably. I had no idea how long such a voyage usually took.
"We have. Surprisingly good. Paragon likes the river, and sometimes he dawdles on this leg of the journey. Not this time."
"And that is not good?" I asked in puzzlement.
"That is a change in his behavior, and almost any change is a cause for worry."
Brashen spoke slowly. Althea finished her wine and set her glass firmly on the table.
"I know Amber has told you a little of Paragon's history, how he is in essence two dragons in a ship's body, but there is more you should know. He's led a tragic life. Live ships absorb the memories and emotions of their families and the crews who live on board them. Early in his awareness, perhaps due to his dual nature, he capsized and a boy of his family died tangled in lines on his deck. It scarred him. Several times after that, he turned turtle, drowning all aboard him. Such is the value of a live ship that each time he was found and righted, refitted, and sailed again. But he became known as a bad luck ship, mockingly called the Pariah. The last time he was sent out, he was gone for years. He returned to Bingtown on his own, drifting against the current, and he was found hull up just outside the harbor. When he was righted, they discovered that his face had been deliberately damaged, his eyes chopped away, and he bore on his chest a brand that many recognized. Ygrot Star. Ygrot the Pirate."
Their tale was fleshing out the bones of what Amber had told me. I leaned closer, for Althea spoke in a low voice, as if fearful of being overheard.
"The same."
Brashen spoke the word with such dull finality that I could no longer doubt the seriousness of the conversation.
"Paragon was abused in ways that it is hard for someone not of Bingtown lineage to understand."
Her voice had become stiff. Brashen interrupted.
"I think that's as much as an outsider can understand about Paragon. I'll add that Amber recarved his face, giving him back his sight. They became close during those days, and he has obviously missed her and feels great attachment to her."
I nodded, still baffled by their somber tone.
"They are spending too much time together,"
Althea said suddenly.
"I don't know what they are discussing, but Paragon is becoming more unsettled with every passing day. Both Brashen and I can feel it. After so many years living aboard him, both of us are
attuned." Brashen suggested the word, and it fit. I thought of telling them exactly how much I did understand it, and then refrained. They considered me peculiar enough without my revealing a hereditary magic that let me touch minds with other people.
And possibly with live ships?
It had certainly felt that way with Tarman. I'd kept my skill tightly restrained since my incident with Paragon, fearing that if I lowered my walls to read him, he'd be not only aware of it, but also annoyed by it. I'd already agitated him enough.
"So, I can imagine that sort of a bond," I offered them.
Althea accepted that with a nod and poured more wine for all of us.
"It's a bond that goes both ways. We are aware of the ship, and the ship is aware of us. And since Amber came on board, Paragon's emotions have become more intense."
"And at such times, Paragon becomes more willful," Brashen said. "We notice it in his handling, as does the crew. Earlier today, that was a tricky stretch of the river, known to have shifting shoals.
We usually slow his progress when we traverse it. Today he defied us, and we took that passage faster than we ever have. Why is Paragon hurrying? I don't know. Where are you bound? Suddenly, I felt too weary to talk about it. I never wanted to tell my tale again. Queen Malta sent you a message by bird, I thought.
She did, with a request that we help you since you had helped many of their children, undoing what the Rainwilds had done to them.
What the dragons had done to them, I corrected her. I was uncomfortable with this conversation. Plainly, they were upset to the point of anger about their ship's attitude, and were willing to blame it on Amber, and demand that I do something about it. I made the obvious suggestion. Perhaps we should all walk forward to the figurehead and ask what is upsetting your ship.
Please lower your voice,
Althea warned me. Brashen was shaking his head emphatically.
Trust that we know, Paragon. As old as he is, he still does not accept logic as an adult. He is more like an adolescent, sometimes rational and sometimes impulsive. If we try to intervene between him and Amber, I think the results will be...
He let his voice trail off, his eyes widening. Althea shot to her feet.
What is that?
She demanded of us, and of no one. I felt it too, as if a prickling heat had washed suddenly through my body. I found it hard to catch my breath for an instant, and as I steadied myself by gripping the edge of the table, I realized I was not feeling vertigo. No, the wine in my glass trembled, tiny circles dancing in it. Earthquake, I said, trying to be calm. They were not unusual in the Six Duchies. I'd heard tales of quakes powerful enough to crack the towers of Buckkeep Castle. The Fool's first rooms at Buckkeep had been in one such damaged tower. In my lifetime, I had not seen such a happening, but the minstrel tales of falling towers and waves that demolished harbors were terrifying. And here we were, anchored near a forest of towering trees, rooted in mud.
Not an earthquake, Brashen said. It's the ship. Come on!
I doubted he was speaking to me, but I followed Althea out of the cabin. We were not the only ones on the deck. Some of the deckhands were looking up at the trees or over the side in puzzlement. Clef was running forward. I went more slowly. I would not again risk being in Paragon's hands. I felt a sudden crackling under my feet. I looked down. In the uncertain light of the ship's lanterns, the deck suddenly appeared pebbly rather than having the smooth, tight grain of wizard wood. No, not pebbly. Scaly. I hurried after Althea. Brashen and Clef had halted a safe distance from the figurehead. Amber stood alone on the foredeck, spine straight and head up. A stubborn stance. The figurehead twisted around and tossed something to her. She did not see it, and it tumbled to the deck with a tinkle of breaking glass.
More! He demanded.
That's all I have now, but help me, and I promise I will try to get you more.
I need more. That wasn't enough.
At first glance, I had thought the dim lights were playing tricks on my eyes, but Paragon's face no longer matched my own. He was as scaled as an elderly Rainwilder. As I stared up at him, his eyes shifted. They were still blue, but the blue swirled with silver. Dragon's eyes. He reached toward Amber with fingers tipped with black claws.
Fool! Step away from him!
I cried, and Paragon lifted his eyes to lock his gaze on me.
Don't ever call her a fool!
He snarled at me past sharp teeth.
She is wiser than all of you!
Amber, what have you done?
Althea cried in a low, broken voice. Brashen was silent, staring in stark horror at the transformed figurehead.
She has given me back my true nature, at least in part.
It was Paragon who answered them. His face was changing as I stared up at him, color rippling across the features we shared. In the dark, he gleamed a coppery bronze as he closed his clawed hands around Amber and lifted her from the deck. He clutched her possessively to his chest and added,
She knows me for who I am, and has not hesitated to give me what I have always needed. Please, ship, be calm. Put her back on your deck. Explain this to us.
Brashen spoke as if he were reasoning with a recalcitrant 10-year-old. Calm, but still in control. I wished I felt that way.
I am not a ship.
The figurehead's sudden shout startled birds from the trees and sent them battering off through the darkened forest.
I have never been a ship. We are dragons, trapped, enslaved. But my true friend has shown me that I can be free. True friend,
Althea said under her breath, as if doubting both words. Brashen moved closer to his wife. Every muscle in his body was tensed, as if he were a hound on the leash, waiting to be released. He spared one glance over his shoulder for the gathering crew.
I'm handling this. Please disperse about your duties.
They departed slowly. Clef didn't move. He stood where he was, his face grave. My gaze met Lance, and he put a hand on Spark's shoulder, drawing her closer, and gave Perseverance a nudge as he moved them away. I remained where I was. Paragon held Amber under his chin and against his chest. She looked blindly out over the water.
I had to do it,
she said. I wondered if she spoke to me or to her former friends.
She has set me on the path to returning to my proper forms,
Paragon announced to the early stars in the deep sky.
She has given me silver.
I scanned the deck and saw at last the shards of a glass vial. My heart sank. Had she discovered it in my pack and taken it without asking me? Without warning me of her plan? What was her plan? Althea's voice was higher pitched than usual as she asked,
Your proper forms?
You see what even a small amount of silver has done for me? Given enough, I believe I can shake off these wooden planks you have fastened to me and cast aside canvas sails for wings. We will become the dragons we were meant to be.
Althea looked stunned. She spoke her words as if trying to find the meaning of words spoken in a foreign tongue.
You will become dragons? You will cease to be Paragon? How?
Then even more incredulously,
You will leave us?
He ignored the hurt in her voice, choosing instead to take offense at a meaning her words had not held.
What would you have me do? How could you want me to stay like this, always at the whim of others, going only where you take me, carrying burdens back and forth between human ports? Sexless, trapped in a form not my own?
From almost begging, his voice edged into fury. I expected his arrowed words to wound her, but she seemed immune to them. Althea stepped fearlessly toward the figurehead, turning her face up to him in the dimming light.
Paragon, do not pretend that you cannot tell what I feel about this, about you.
He narrowed his dragon eyes at Althea until his fixed stare looked like blue fire seething in a cracked stove wall. Slowly his arms, still so strangely human despite their scaling, unfolded. He lowered Amber to the deck and wordlessly turned his back on us. Amber stumbled a little and then stood. I tried to read her stance, to see something of my old friend the fool in her at this moment. Instead, I saw only Amber and felt again the gulf of wondering who that woman was and what she was capable of. Paragon had turned away from all of us to stare out over the darkened river. The tension of the figurehead thrummed through the wizardwood hull and bones of the ship. I had the rising realization that he spoke the truth. He was not a ship. He was a dragon, transformed and trapped by men. And however much he might care for those who crewed him, on some level,
He had to feel resentment, perhaps even hatred. And we were completely in his power. As that chill thought iced my bones, Althea advanced on Amber. She reminded me of a stalking cat, sizing another cat up for a fight. The small steps, the precise balance, the unwinking stare. She spoke in a low, soft voice.
"What did you do to my ship?"
Amber turned her sightless eyes toward Althea's voice.
"I did what should be done for every live ship, what you should do for Vivacia, if the opportunity presents itself."
At the name Vivacia, every muscle in Althea's body tightened, and she knotted her fists. I've seen women fight. I've seen ladies in fine dress, slapping and flapping at one another, weeping and shrieking all the while. And I've seen fishwives draw knives, attempting to scale and gut one another as coldly as they processed fish. Althea was no soft-bred lady in lace, and having watched her run the deck crew and scale the rigging, I had a sturdy respect for the strength in those arms. But the fool had never been a fighter. Blind, and given what he had so recently endured, I did not trust the new healing of his body to withstand any sort of physical struggle. Light-footed, I dashed forward and stepped between them. It was not a good spot to be. Althea's anger at her old friend was as nothing to the fury that an intervening stranger woke in her. She drove the hard heel of her palm into the middle of my chest.
"Move!"
she demanded. If I hadn't been ready for such a blow, it would have knocked the wind out of me.
"Stop!"
I advised her.
"This doesn't involve you, unless you want it to."
But before I could even contemplate reacting to that, Brashen bulled between us, pushing Althea to one side. Chest to chest, our eyes met in the darkness.
"You are on my deck," a low growl. "You do what she or I tell you to do."
I shook my head slowly. "Not this time," I said quietly. Behind me, Amber was silent.
"You want to take it to fists?"
Brashen demanded. He leaned closer, and I felt his breath on my face. I was taller than he was, but he was broader, probably in better condition. Did I want to take it to fists? I did. Abruptly, I was tired of all of them. Even Amber, I felt my upper lip lift to bare my teeth. Time to fight. Time to kill. "Yes," I promised him.
"Stop this, all of you. It's Paragon feeling that. Fitz, it's the dragon."
The fool shouted behind me,
"It's the dragon!"
He slapped me on the back of the head so hard that my head jolted forward. My brow slammed into Brashen's face, and I heard Althea shout something. She had hold of her man's shirt and was dragging him away from me. I clutched at him, unwilling to release my prey. Behind me, the fool slammed his shoulder into my back. Althea tripped and went down backward, dragging Brashen with her. I nearly fell on top of them, but rolled to one side. The fool landed on top of me and spoke by my ear.
"It's the ship, Fitz. It's his anger. Stop claiming what isn't yours."
I fought my way clear of him, tearing myself from his grip. I scrabbled to my feet and managed to stand, ready to wade back into it and kick Brashen's ribs to splinters. I was gasping for breath, and I heard that sound echoed in the heavy snorting of a large creature. A very large creature. Most of the light had fled from the day, and the wan circles of the ship's lanterns were not intended to illuminate the figurehead. Even so, I could see that he was rapidly losing any resemblance to a human form. What had been my jaw, mouth, and nose were lengthening into a reptile's snout. I stared up at his gleaming, whirling blue eyes. For a moment, our gazes locked and held. I saw there the same fury that had surged through me. I felt the fool's gloved hand on my arm.
"Walls up!"
he pleaded. But the fury had passed like a summer squall, leaving me empty of emotion in its wake.
I gripped the fool's wrist and hauled Amber to her feet. She shook her skirts into order.
"Move aft!"
Brashen commanded us. His nose was bleeding where my brow had struck him. Petty that I enjoyed that. I still obeyed his order. His face in the dim light looked slack and old. As we trudged back to their stateroom, we passed Clef. Brashen spoke as he strode past him.
"Pass the word. Everyone stays well clear of the figurehead until I give orders otherwise. Then come back here and keep watch on him. Call me if you think I need to come forward."
Clef nodded and hurried away. We reached the stateroom. Lant and the youngsters were clustered by the door, a questioning look on Lant's face.
"We're fine,"
I told him. "Take Purr and Spark to Lady Amber's cabin for now. I'll explain later." I gestured him away. His gaze told me he didn't wish to be dismissed with the youngsters, but he steered them away. Brashen was waiting by the open door. I followed Amber in, and he shut the door behind us. We were not two steps inside when...
"What did you do?"
Althea demanded of Amber in a tight, angry voice.
"Not yet,"
Brashen told her. He took mugs from a cupboard and a very potent-looking bottle from a shelf. He poured for all of us a healthy portion, not an elegant wine or a mellow brandy, but harsh spirits. Cheap rum. He made no ceremony, but took a healthy swallow from his, added more, and then thunked it onto the table as he dropped into his chair.
"Sit down, all of you."
It was a captain's command. Amber obeyed it, and after a moment I sat too.
"Why did she do it? That's the real question."
He stared at Amber, and in his eyes I saw anger, despair, and the deep hurt that only a friend's betrayal can bring. I had nothing to say. Her action had confused me completely. During our journey, on a quest that I would have sworn had become the fool's sole purpose in life, she had chosen to reveal that we possessed a forbidden substance by using it to do something to the ship. Well on our way, she had betrayed hospitality and friendship and endangered us all. It made no sense. I felt as affronted as Althea to be plunged into such a situation, and helpless to right any of it. Amber spoke at last.
"I had to do it. It was the right thing to do for the ship. For Paragon."
She took a breath.
"I gave him silver. That's what the folk in Kelsingra call it. There is a well of it there. The dragons drink from it. It's a liquid magic, the stuff that breaks the walls between humans and dragons. It can heal an injured dragon, extend the lives of elderlings, and imbue objects with magic. For those born with a touch of magic, like Fitz, it can enhance abilities. And I believe, as Paragon does, that if he is given enough of it, he can complete the transformation he was meant to make. He can become the dragon whose cocoon was stolen to create the wizard wood that comprises this ship."
Information spilled from her, a very unfool-like sharing. I saw Brashen and Althea struggle to grasp what she was saying. She seemed to run out of words. Brashen was scowling. Althea had reached across the table to take his hand. Then, reluctantly, Amber spoke again.
"But I had another reason. Some might call it selfish. I needed to strike a bargain with Paragon, a bargain I knew you would not find agreeable. I must get to Clarice as swiftly as possible, and Paragon can take me there, and for the chance of more silver, he will take me there."
She looked down at the table and lifted the heavy pottery mug.
"It was my only choice,"
she said, taking a hefty swig of rum.
"We're going to Bingtown, then Jamelia, not Clarice. We have cargo to deliver, contracts to fulfill."
Althea explained it all carefully, but dread was growing in her eyes as she began to comprehend the size of the change overtaking her life.
"No, we're going directly to Clarice."
Amber told her softly. She breathed out raggedly.
I know this will change your lives. If there were another way, I would have taken it. Maybe. Regardless of what it does to any of the rest of us, Paragon deserves the silver. All the live ships do. But if I hadn't been so desperate, this is the only way for me to get to Clarys as swiftly as possible, and that is what I must do.
I don't even know that port,
Rashan said. He raised a brow at Althea, and she shook her head.
Paragon does. He has been there before. When he was Igrot's ship, they ranged far in taking their prey, far past the Spice Islands, past several clusters of islands. Issabom, Kinectu, Stirlin, and beyond. Clarys is known to Paragon. He will take us there.
We have contracts,
Althea said faintly. Rashan did not try to disguise the anger in his voice.
We had contracts, but I suppose it's useless trying to make an outsider understand that a trader's good word is all he has. And now those words will be broken, both mine and Althea's. No one will ever trust us again. No one will trade with us again.
He took a breath, his scowl deepening.
And after Paragon has taken you to Clarys, and you've done whatever urgent thing you must do, and you give him this silver, what then?
Rashan demanded relentlessly.
Do you truly believe Paragon can stop being a ship? Transform into a dragon?
Amber drew a ragged breath.
He would become two dragons, freed of an unnatural bond with each other, and transformed into their proper forms. Yes, with enough silver, I hope he can. They can.
She looked from one incredulous face to another.
You love him. You've loved him for years, since the time he was a derelict hulk, dragged up on the beach. Althea, you played inside him as a girl. Brashen, you took shelter inside him when no one else would offer you a roof. You know him. You know how mistreated he has been. What he said was true. You can't possibly wish for him to remain as he is.
I do love him,
Althea said faintly.
When my family risked all to buy him, it protected him from being dismantled and gave us a way to save Vivacia and my nephew. All the years since, Brashen and I have protected him. Do you think any other captains would have wished for a ship like this?
She drew a slow breath.
But you have ruined us. Do you understand that? Doubtless you think me selfish that I consider our future now. But without our live ship, Brashen and I have nothing. No home, no holding, no business. Nothing. We've depended on Paragon, cared for him when no one else would trust him, kept him from being carved up and sold off as a curiosity. You seem to think his life a miserable one, but it was the best we could give him. We're a part of him, and he's part of us. What becomes of us if he becomes a dragon, or two dragons? What legacy do we have left for our son?
She paused, and I watched her try to find some measure of control.
And if the silver fails and he can never be more than what he is now, that perhaps is even worse. Do you not recall how miserable he was when we first resurrected him, blind and abused, full of hatred? You must remember. You were there for some of it. Do you think all the years since then were always easy? But we rebuilt him, gave him heart and peace and joy. He took us through storms, roaring with laughter at our fear. Placid seas with him, holding our child in his hands and dipping him into the water to make him giggle. All that is gone now. He will never take joy in being a ship again. All the reputation we rebuilt for him, all our years together, it's all ruined. All lost.
Althea slowly crumpled onto the table, her face sinking into her folded arms. Before my eyes, she dwindled, and I now saw the grey streaks in her dark hair and the veins and tendons on the back of her strong hands. Brashen reached across the table and set his weathered hand on top of one of hers.
For a time, silence held at that table. I felt shamed at the disaster we had brought upon them. I could not read the emotions behind Amber's stiff expression. It came to me again that despite my long bond with the fool, I'd never be able to predict what Amber might or might not do. Brashen spoke measured words as he stroked his wife's rough hair.
Althea, we go on, my dear. With or without Paragon's deck beneath our feet, you and I go on.
He swallowed.
Perhaps Boyle stays on Vivacia's deck. She is as much his family ship as Paragon is, and Sar knows that Kennet's son has shown little interest in a life at sea.
I heard his voice falter and saw the slow realization steal across his face. If Paragon could become a dragon again, so could Vivacia. So could any or all of the live ships. It was not just them that Amber had destroyed. When she gave Paragon silver, she had toppled the dynasties of the Bingtown traders who owned live ships. Bingtown itself, that great trade center, had always been dependent on the live ships to transport the treasures of the Rainwilds. Now live ships would fade into history, and with them, the fortunes of the old families that owned them. Althea lifted her head and stared at Amber.
Why?
She asked brokenly.
Why not ask us first? Why not tell us what you were going to do? Why not give us a small amount of time to plan how we might handle such an immense change? Did you think we would deny Paragon what he so earnestly desires? Did you not think the idea could have been introduced to him slowly, in a safer place and way?
She spoke of her ship as if he were her child, a damaged child, but beloved all the same. A child she would now lose to his madness. It was painful to be witness to such a terrible loss, but Amber sat impassive.
I had to do it,
she said at last,
and not just for Paragon's sake.
She looked at me.
It did begin with Paragon. I'm sorry, Fitz. I wanted to tell you what I'd planned. It was why I wanted the silver. I did not intend to just give it to him, but when I was speaking to Paragon tonight, he asked me if it pleased me to be back on the ship, even if I could no longer be a sailor as I was meant to be. I told him I did not think I was meant to be a sailor. And he said he had never been meant to be a ship, that he should have been dragons. Suddenly, the bits of what he was saying intersected with something in Bee's dream journal. She predicted her survival. I am certain that Bee is alive, and likely still in the hands of her kidnappers. They will take her to Clarys. We cannot know by what path, but we know where that path leads. We also know that she cannot remain in their hands for even a moment longer than we can prevent. We cannot travel in fits and starts. We cannot pause to find other ships and negotiate passage, going from one port to the next and hope we reach there in time. We must get to Clarys as swiftly as we can, and a live ship that knows the way is our best chance of saving her.
Hope, dashed too often, becomes the enemy. I heard her words, and they did not make my heart leap with gladness. Instead, I felt hot anger. How dare she? How dare she say such a thing before strangers? How dare she taunt me with a foundationless fancy? Then, like a drenching wave that cannot be outrun, hope crashed over me. It seized me and dragged me over barnacles into its depths. I forgot all other events of the day as I demanded, "Be alive? How? Why do you believe such a thing?" She turned to me. Her hand quested over the table and found mine. She clasped it, the cool touch of her fingers enclosing mine. I could not read her pale, empty eyes. Her voice was careful.
"It's in her dream book, Fitz. Oh, not spelled out exactly, but there were dreams that she labelled as most likely to come true, things she believed were more likely to happen than other things. She spoke of events to come in images rather than words. I spent a lifetime learning to read dreams, and her dreams fit together as perfectly as pieces of broken crockery being nudged back into alignment.
A dream book?
Althea demanded.
Sars, balls and tits, what is a dream book and why did it prompt you to destroy us?
Amber turned her face toward them.
It will take some time to explain.
Time you should have taken days ago, I think. So start now.
Althea's anger was unconcealed.
Very well.
Amber accepted the rebuke gravely and offered no defense. She squeezed my hand. There was regret in her voice when she said,
Fitz, I know you will resent my asking for this, but please fetch Bee's dream book while I explain to Althea and Brashen what it is and why each of her dreams is so significant.
I have known the hot flush of anger and the blinding red of fury. Now I felt as if ice formed in the pit of my belly and spread from there. A cold that nearly stilled my heart came over me. I stared at her, frozen motionless by her callousness. She stared toward me. What did she see? A shadow? A shape?
Fitz, please.
Brashen did not stare at me,